Drawing room over here.
You made it. Oh, come on through. Do you fancy drink? What's your tipple? Welcome to the Drawing Room, a space for intimate and surprising conversations. I'm Andy Park. In a 1968 episode of Star Trek, the writers dreamt up a new engine called an ion engine, a fanciful form of propulsion. Now, some years later, NASA, yes, that NASA, inspired by Star Trek, decided to prototype the engine, and guess what? It worked. Now, that's often quoted as an example of science fiction's informing or even inspiring science. These days, Dr. Brad Tucker and Dr. Natasha Hurley-Walker are highly regarded scientists and experts in their field of astrophysics and radio astronomy. But once upon a time, they were young people too, and they looked at Star Trek and Star Wars for some of their inspiration. So how did they get from there to here? Let's find out. Brad, Natasha, welcome to the Drawing Room.
Thanks so much, Andy.
Thanks.
Let's talk a bit about what you're doing now. Brad, you study supernovas and the explosion of stars. What do we know about why stars go supernova?
So there's actually a couple of different ways, believe it or not, that stars blow up. Usually, it's kind of because they run out of fuel. There's this epic battle between pressure and gravity on the inside of a star. And ultimately, as the star uses its fuel, it runs out of it. Gravity pulls it down. It collapses on itself and blows up. But some stars can actually come back to life, so to speak, as they slowly die and decay, something like where a sun will do, it'll turn into a white dwarf. That white dwarf can, if it's near another star, act like a vampire, sucking off the atmosphere or the photosphere, as we say, of another star, eating it all up, and then it gets too heavy and it blows up as well. And what we now know is there's a lot of stars blowing up in the universe, about 50 a second. And so there's a lot of great things to see. You know, who loves a good explosion in the sky?
And what about you, Natasha? You're exploring the universe using low radio frequencies, aren't you?
Yeah, that's right. So I work with telescopes in the very radio quiet Murchison Radio Astronomy Observatory. And yeah, I'm using frequencies that this show is probably going out on, and which is why we build the telescopes up in the outback, where we have no radio interference from, TV shows, radio shows, and mobile phones. And yeah, I look at exploding stars as well occasionally. I look at them a little bit after they've died. So a long time later, that explosion will hit the surrounding space and it'll basically create like a glowing shell in radio. For me, it looks like a soap bubble suspended in the universe. And so these are called supernova remnants. So that's one of the many aspects of astrophysics that you can do with radio astronomy.
So let's head back in time now, maybe not as far as the supernovas that you're studying, but to your own childhood. Natasha, where did the love of science begin? Was there a clear moment of inspiration for you? And were you a Trekkie? Let's just get it over and done with.
Well, I am a little bit too young to have watched the original series, but I was about 6 years old when Star Trek The Next Generation aired. And well, let's just say it was a sort of mind-blowing, life-changing moment when I saw that crew boldly go off to new places. And also, if you look back at TNG, it had some really good astrophysics in it. Even in season one, they go and visit a pulsar, which is a kind of rotating neutron star that sends out these powerful beams of radio waves. 20 years later, I was doing a project on pulsars, and now it's something that I'm working on again. So like, you can trace this straight line all the way from Star Trek to where I am now.
That is funny, because often scientists get frustrated by the science or the shorthand of science in movies, but you thought that it was okay and it holds up. It's quite a remarkable fact. What about you, Brad? Were you inspired by early Star Trek episodes of visiting pulsars? Was it something else on the big screen that started to fire your imagination as a child?
To be honest, no. And I know that's usually the surprising answer. I wasn't interested in science as a kid. I wasn't like, hey, bad science. It wasn't a thing. And I wasn't actually that interested in science fiction either. Like, believe it or not, I didn't even see Star Wars until I was 25. I know I'm about to get kicked off the show, but it was true. It was just my now wife sat me down and made me watch it, which is quite comical, as now I actually do a lot of research and interest in the actions and interaction that science fiction has on public perception and understanding. And it was exactly kind of what you were just mentioning, that whole inspirational view is actually a big one that we realize, that seeing visions of our futuristic future and options for what we can do in the future inspires people, not just into science, but to be inquisitive or wonder or think. And that's one of the big legacies that science fiction has.
It's true, though, that the role of science fiction in assisting science is more than just firing the young minds of tomorrow. It's also something a little bit more practical in terms of how research gets commissioned. Even the inventions we eventually think of as everyday, like tricorders in our pockets, they're mobile phones today. So there is a tangible, more practical link, isn't there, Natasha?
Yeah, I think a fantastic example of this, and actually I would have read these books when I was a kid, is Arthur C. Clarke. So he actually suggested that we could use satellites orbiting the Earth as a form of, you know, communications network. And that was well before we had launched things into space to go around the Earth. So he predicted that. And one that's very close to my heart is there's a scene in one of his books where some characters are trying to understand a message from space. And they go to this old radio array that nobody is using anymore. It's thousands and thousands of radio telescope dishes arranged around South Africa. And it's old and it's defunct because this, you know, this is set in like the future of 2020 or something. And they use the dishes to understand the radio signal. But the reason that they're not using those dishes anymore is because now radio astronomers have built their dishes on the far side of the moon. And of course, what's amazing is we are right now talking about building a very large array of radio telescopes in South Africa and Australia. It's called the Square Kilometer Array. So he predicted that sort of 50 years before it happened. And in the future, we are indeed hoping to build radio telescopes on the far side of the moon. So you can literally be visionary sometimes.
Brad, as part of National Science Week, you're looking at Mars Attacks, the seminal 1996 film by Tim Burton. I think you had Jack Nicholson in that movie, a rather less friendly look at alien civilizations, however comical. How was the alien science imagined in that film?
So it's quite interesting. You know, generally when we see aliens, there's a lot to it, because you know, there's always perception that aliens are harmful and dangerous. They're coming over to take us. But you can actually chalk aliens down to two clear, or maybe three clear ideas. There's one, there's kind of the Star Trek, Star Wars universe of being explorers and seeing kind of almost the everyday life. But then when aliens often come to Earth, like in Mars Attacks, they are hostile. They're coming over to take you, with pretty much the one exception being E.T. But conversely, when we go visit alien worlds in science fiction, we are peaceful explorers. And there's so much in science fiction that is actually kind of a projection of our own fears and worries, that we use the alien motif to explore that knowledge. And in fact, that's one of the powers, I think, that science fiction, especially aliens and space, has. You know, Star Trek, it was quite profound and talking about social issues in the 60s and 70s. You know, there was famous for saying we couldn't talk about the Vietnam War because they were actually being censored. But if it's the Vietnam War on another planet, it's okay because it's another planet. So it has this really interesting way of exploring our own human nature in a very safe yet clear setting.
Yeah, it is interesting to think about all of the fantastic science fiction of the 20th century, which was in parallel with the first manned missions to other planets, so to the moon, for example, and in general, the space race. Obviously, they could have harnessed some of the propaganda in science fiction to try and get one over the Russians. Does the technology in science fiction tell us something about the time it was created in, or is it a link to the future, Natasha?
So I think the technology is really, you know, it's based on the technology that you've got around you. But I do agree with Brad here. What's really interesting is kind of the what it tells you about your society. I think a kind of an interesting example that speaks for me here is Kim Stanley Robinson's Mars trilogy. So he wrote this in the 90s, this great set of books about colonizing Mars, which is obviously very much in the popular imagination now, but wasn't really at the time. So he's sort of fomented this discussion and this looking outward and this idea that, you know, we would go there. But if you look at the books that he's writing now, he's capturing a different kind of sort of future that we are worried about. And I love one of his recent books called Aurora, which it sends a group of people out to colonize another star system. But it's so far away, it has to be what's called a generation ship. So each generation, you know, gives birth to the next generation and they're still on the ship. And it asks these really difficult questions about what are the ethics of doing this? You know, what are we losing by separating ourselves from the Earth? And I think that's capturing some of the concerns of our time now. So, yeah, I do love how it's both looking forward but also holding up a mirror to where we are at the moment.
On ABCRN, I'm Andy Park. Dr. Natasha Hurley-Walker and Dr. Brad Tucker are my guests in the drawing room. We're chatting about what effect science fiction has on science and what effect science could have on science fiction. I mean, some of the magic things we're building that seem like science fiction, the fields of satellites, for example, are they making your jobs harder? I mean, I see reports about the way satellites are already clouding the sky, Brad.
Yeah, I mean, and this is a hot topic, and it's one of the interesting issues that affects optical astronomy like me, as well as radio astronomy. You know, there's these rare situations, because, as you said, on one hand, satellites have a lot of opportunity for doing amazing things and very critical things to the operation of life, from detecting bushfires, monitoring water flows, communication. You know, so many people are actually now having Starlink, SpaceX's internet service in Australia, where they previously were missing. So there's an equitable issue here. But, as he said, we're soon approaching this world where looking up, instead of seeing stars, you see satellites. And then if we reflect on this in science fiction, you know, that science fiction has that beauty of connecting the reality to the imagined. And so when you look up at the stars, what would it be like to visit that planet or travel across the universe or go visit a pulsar, as we just heard? But now imagine a sky where you look up and you just see these human things that we put up there. How will that affect the psyche in addition to the science that we're trying to do? And there's interesting and important conversations being had and trying to have in the global community.
I wonder, and this is probably going to sound like a really stupid question, but how much time do you both actually spend looking at the sky with your naked eye? Or is it more desk work, computer work, looking at images on computer screens, Natasha?
I mean, I think, obviously my actual day job, I spend most of my time looking at a computer. I use supercomputers to process all of my data. So, you know, there's a lot of desk work involved. However, I do find I look at the sky a lot more than like most people. I remember one time I was out walking and I saw, you know, I'm always looking up. I saw what's called a circumzenithal arc. It's like an upside down rainbow that only appears at the very, very top of the sky. And I was just, you know, walking, just entranced by this thing, you know, incredible, beautiful optical phenomenon. Walking along, and there was somebody else also walking along with their head in the sky. And we got all the way right close to each other before we realized we're both radio astronomers at the same institute. You know, just in a random park at the weekend. Of course, the only other person who spotted this thing is another astronomer. So I think it is a job that, does encourage you to look up.
When they make the biopic of your career and your achievements, that is going to be the meet cute at the start, I'm sure. What about you, Brad? I mean, that idea of just seeing the sky without the technology to almost get in the way. Does that happen to you much?
It does. I do a lot of visits to schools and the public, and it's the enjoyment I get is almost the enjoyment of watching someone else from the first time. You know, there is nothing like seeing Saturn with your own eyes, you know, through a telescope, because it's great. You look at Saturn and, you know, people are expecting, oh, maybe it's a blob or a bright light, and you show them through even a moderate sized telescope and they look at it and they're like, wow, it looks like Saturn. You know, it's exactly as advertised. So few things come that way. And so there's just this bit of enjoyment I get by seeing, you know, that first reaction that someone has. And I think it's a special connection, and it's a connection that we keep having to the stars and the universe and space, and one that is deeply embedded in the people who have lived on this continent for 60,000 years and their connections to the sky, stars, and land. And I think it's a beautiful thing to keep sharing and keep almost that legacy a bit going on by enabling access to people who have never seen it before.
And giving people that have never seen it before images, material, really feeds particularly children's imagination. What's it been like seeing the images from the James Webb Telescope, Natasha?
Oh, it's just been tremendous. You know, we've been waiting for this for 10, 20 years. So, yeah, it's fantastic. Some of the galaxies they're seeing are from just after, well, we started having galaxies in the universe, so some of the very first galaxies. So that's amazing. But I also do want to give a shout out to the Event Horizon Telescope, because they made those images of the black holes in our own galaxy and another galaxy called M87. And as a radio astronomer, I have to say, you know, that's epic radio astronomy right there. Yeah, it's the equivalent, what did they say? It's like imaging a 10-cent piece on the moon. And getting all the details right. Like, it's just phenomenal. And so, yeah, I'm thrilled to be alive at this time where we're investing in science and building these great instruments that help humanity see further.
Brad, should we be just a little bit worried that there are supermassive black holes at the middle of each galaxy?
I think it's a thing to enjoy. We get to watch it from a safe distance. And, you know, there's a few stars that are harmed in the filming of our images watching it. But it's a great thing. And, you know, connecting that beautiful, you know, image of the black supermassive black hole that Natasha was just saying, you know, what's amazing to me is that previously people were using the modeling of the supermassive black hole and like images and stuff from the movie Interstellar. And there's a beautiful piece of work that you can search on YouTube where the double negative and the team who created the graphics for Interstellar show that how you take their black hole, which was so scientifically accurate, they actually did some cool stuff with it, that you can kind of then change its shape and a little bit of orientation and appear exactly as the Event Horizon Telescope image of the supermassive black hole. And so that was such a powerful tool of connecting that real image to the huge benefit that science fiction has of being able to take it that little step further, and then also people, you know, have some fun enjoying a nice supermassive black hole on the screen and in reality.
I love that movie. I saw it again just last week, and I just can't get enough of some of the end stage abstract kind of concepts in that film. It just blows my mind. Speaking of blowing our minds, I want you both to sort of throw it forward 5, 10, 15 years. I'll start with you, Natasha. Where is your science going? What is the next big platform, the next big thing?
So we're building the world's largest radio telescope, the Square Kilometre Array, and that will be here in Western Australia. The low frequency part of it will be the stage that I'm working on, and that'll be sited here. And there's also a sort of medium high frequency instrument over in South Africa. So this is just going to be transformative, going to allow us to image galaxies like right into the distant universe in the radio, which it gives us a different measure than things like James Webb Space Telescope. There's going to be, you know, much better chances of doing SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, with such a huge array. And so, you know, looking for life around nearby stars, that's a really exciting possibility. And something that I'm working on a lot at the moment is looking for really unexpected phenomena. So earlier this year, I had a nice paper in Nature where we found a new kind of radio source that literally nobody had ever seen before. It repeats every 20 minutes, this kind of unexpected expected repetition rate. And so I think it's just very clear there's still a lot out there to discover. And we won't even know what the big discoveries are going to be in 10 years' time.
What about you, Brad? I mean, what is the, you know, blow our minds. What's the next cool thing in your area of science?
So I think there's a couple. You know, people are obviously, as we heard, just the James Webb. It, you know, a team of mine that I've been working on, it was a great postdoc in Baltimore, started to find the first supernova with the James Webb Space Telescope. And this is kind of where we're looking towards. In a year or two's time, we're going to have something called the Vera Rubin Observatory being built in Chile that Australia has joined. And astronomers like myself are super excited to use, because this thing is going to be mapping essentially the southern sky and the optical colors, the colors we can see with our eyes, multiple times. It's essentially every 3 days almost covering it. And so it's going to find literally tens of thousands of supernova and exploding stars and new things that go bump in the night. We're kind of, we often sometimes view the universe as this thing that just stays there and doesn't change. But the universe is actually quite dynamic. Stars are evolving, galaxies are changing, planets are moving, asteroids are forming and bumping into things. And so it's going to capture that activity in a way of the universe that we've just never been able to see. And then we have an even new space telescope after that called the Roman Space Telescope, after Nancy Grace Roman. And this will, again, take a look at the far distant edges of the universe, but looking to try and measure things like what we call dark energy. And this is something that we've desperately wanted to know. It makes up 70% of everything in the universe, yet we don't know exactly what it is, but we do know it's causing the universe to grow, and that somehow, some way, way distant in the future, will cause the universe to end. And so this is going to give us this huge insight into the evolution of stars and galaxies, but also then the evolution of the universe itself.
Very cool work that you both do. Natasha and Brad, it's been great to have you in the drawing room. Thank you.
Great to be here. Thanks, Andy.
Thanks, Andy.
Dr. Natasha Hurley-Walker and Dr. Brad Tucker have been my guests in the drawing room. Natasha is a radio astronomer at the International Centre for Radio Astronomy Research at Curtin University, and Brad is an astrophysicist and cosmologist at ANU. Also, a reminder, of course, this week it's National Science Week, so you can check out great events around the country, including with Brad and Natasha. Just head to scienceweek.net.au to search for what's happening near you. You've been listening to a podcast of The Drawing Room with me, Andy Park. For more great conversations, search for The Drawing Room on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.